This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. This week on Fresh Air, we've been replaying what we feel would be some of your favorite interviews of the year, if we'd asked you. Today, we reach back into our 2013 archives and revisit interviews with comic Amy Schumer and comedian, writer, and filmmaker Mel Brooks. The Mel Brooks interview certainly is one of the favorite things I did for Fresh Air this year. I love the guy and his work. On TV, he wrote for Your Show of Shows and Get Smart. On film, he wrote and directed Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, High Anxiety, and The Producers. And on Broadway, his musical version of The Producers broke the record for the most Tony wins. When I spoke with Mel Brooks in May, it was when PBS presented an American Masters special on Brooks by Richard Trachtenberg called Feel the Noise. Here's the opening story Brooks tells in that special about his formative introduction to the Broadway musical.
Okay, I'm 9 years old. Uncle Joe drove a taxi cab. One day he said, "Hey, Mel, I got two tickets to a brand new show called Anything Goes." And he said, "Well, it's a musical. It's on Broadway. And we've got two seats, the last two seats in the last row of the second balcony." It's thrilling, the Broadway theater. I'm 9 years old.
"Why, it's Gabriel, Gabriel, Cyan, Gabriel, Gabriel, Cyan."
I couldn't catch my breath. There was Ethel Merman. No microphones. And she was still too loud. You know, and it was about 2 miles away. One incredible number after another. I was literally crying with happiness.
Mel Brooks, welcome to Fresh Air.
You're David Bianculli, a pleasure to be here.
What I love about that is that you have so much enthusiasm in your voice. And I've always thought that you couldn't really do a great parody of something unless you understood and enjoyed it.
True. I loved Westerns as a little kid, and I loved horror films. And I had fun with them, but I also saluted the glory of the Western and the glory of James Whale's, you know, Frankenstein and Dracula. And what does a little kid in Brooklyn have when it comes to art? It ain't much, but it's those movies that you got in. And we didn't have any money. I was the baby boy of four, altogether with four brothers. My mother lost her husband. I lost my father. I was only two, and he died of tuberculosis. And we were really, poor. I mean, dead poor. So I cherish those movies because they really lifted my spirits and are indelibly engraved in my brain as important steps in my world education.
And what about, say, Alfred Hitchcock, whom you lampooned in High Anxiety? Those would have come a little later for you, but
much
you clearly
later,
loved those too.
I always thought, you know, that Alfred Hitchcock was the very best director who ever directed films. And I had the idea for High Anxiety. I wrote him a letter saying basically, "Dear Mr. Hitchcock, I do genre parodies. In my estimation, you are a genre. I don't mean that you're overweight. I mean that you've done every style and every type of movie, and that you're just amazing. And I would like to do a movie dedicated to you and based on your style and your work." And he said, he called me and he said, I loved Blazing Saddles. I think you're a very talented guy. And I come to my office. I came to his office at Universal. And he told me to come back every Friday at a quarter to 12, because at 12:30 we would eat. So 45 minutes of work. And he would work on my script on High Anxiety with me. And he said, "Well, don't leave out this and don't leave out that." He said, "What are you going to do about the birds?" I said, "Well, gee, at the moment I haven't included." And he said, "Well, why don't you have them attack you with with their duty?" He said, "It's going to be funny." I said, "Thank you, thank you, Mr. Hitchcock." I loved him. He was colorful. He was sweet, and he saw the rough cut of High Anxiety, and he got up and wiggled by me. Never said a word. I said, "Oh my God, it's I'm ruined. It's terrible." And he left, and 24 hours later, a beautiful wooden box arrives, placed on my desk. It is six magnums of Chateau Aubrion, 1961. Priceless. Maybe the greatest wine ever made, including Rothschild or any other. And with a little note saying, have no anxiety over high anxiety. It's wonderful. Love, Hitch.
The producers, I consider your masterwork, and you've reworked it several very clever times. I want to start with the 1968 movie and play a fast clip and then ask you some questions about it. It's basically about an accountant who discovers that a producer could make a fortune with a flop Broadway show by raising millions for a program that's so bad it would actually close on opening night. In the movie, in the original 1968 film, Zero Mostel plays the producer, Gene Wilder plays the accountant, and in this scene they're going through stacks of scripts looking for a really bad play, which the producer thinks he's just found.
Touch it, touch it. What is it? Smell it. See it? Touch it, touch it. What is it?
What is it? We've struck gold. Not fool's gold, but real gold. The mother lode. The mother lode. The mother of them all. Kiss it, kiss it.
You found a flop.
A flop? That's putting it mildly. We found a disaster, a catastrophe, an outrage, a guarantee to close in one night beauty.
Let's see it.
Let's see. This is freedom for one forever. This is a house in the country. This is a Rolls Royce and a Bentley. This is wine, women, and song, and women.
Springtime for Hitler. A gay romp with Adolf and Eva at Berchtesgaden. Wow.
Wow. It's practically a love letter to Hitler.
This won't run a week.
A week? Are you kidding? This play has got to close on page four.
That was Zero Mostel and Gene Wilder in the original movie version of The Producers. When you won the Oscar for, I guess, Best Original Screenplay for The Producers, you thanked Gene Wilder three times. Why did you do that?
Well, because Gene, like Sid Caesar in my life, I've had a couple of guys. Well, Zero was magnificent, really.
Mm-hmm.
But Gene brought a certain something that was never before. It was kind of creative comedy. And he worked tirelessly. He's really the nucleus, the brilliant key to the emotion of the whole piece.
Well, casting in a lot of your projects is so critical. So to jump to the Broadway version of The Producers, how did you decide, or how quickly did you decide, on Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick?
Well, we already had Nathan right from the beginning. As soon as we thought of Max Bialystock, we thought of Nathan Lane, you know. And Nathan also thought Matthew was a great choice. Matthew is very, very good talent. He's a good singer. He can do anything.
Well, here's an example of their chemistry. This is from the 2005 movie version of The Producers with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. Just a fast clip when they're discussing the upcoming show, and Matthew Broderick's Leo Bloom asks how much money they should be investing in their own show.
Bloom, the two cardinal rules of being a Broadway producer are, one, never put your own money in the show.
And two?
Never put your own money in the show!
Get it?
Got it.
Good.
No matter how many times I hear that, it's laugh out loud funny to me.
And it's true. I believe it. I've never put my own money in the show, you know. I put my talent on the line. And my money I save for Saturday night restaurants.
Now, you watched them perform so many times and then did the movie. How did their onstage chemistry change or deepen over time from your perspective?
Good word, good word, good word, David Bianculli, good word. It deepened. It did deepen because they got to love each other more and more in terms of their characters feeling the emotion for each other. So when finally, you know, near the end of their first year together, when we were in tears when Bloom makes that speech in the courtroom about how good Bialystock really is and how much he loves him. And so it did deepen.
Young Frankenstein came out the same year as Blazing Saddles. The standout scene has Gene Wilder as the scientist and Peter Boyle as the creature singing, putting on the Ritz. And I know that that was not your idea. That was co-writer Gene Wilder's.
Yes.
So how long did it take before you figured out he was right? And then I have a question about what sort of direction you gave to Peter Boyle for that number, especially his singing.
Well, actually, you know, when Gene first brought it up to show the wizardry of this, you know, Dr. Frankenstein coming up with this incredible creature, I mean, reanimating dead tissue. And not only does it move, does it walk and talk, but it also dazzles you with song and dance, you know. I said, I think we're tearing it, Gene. I think, you know, we're going too far. We want some of the verisimilitudinous quality that was in the, you know, in the original James Whale movie, you know, which was serious and scary. And I don't want to lose the seriousness and the scariness of it just for silly comedy, you know, just for taking comedy too far. And he kept pushing. He said, no, no, it will show, demonstrate the doctor's abilities to teach the monster. And finally, he kept bugging me. And I said, look, okay, I'm going to shoot it, and I'm going to put it aside, and we'll see whether or not it's useful in the main body of the picture, okay? And then when I saw it later with all the film that we had collected, I said, gee, it may be the best thing in the film. I called Gene, and I said, you're absolutely right all the time, and I'm glad it's in, totally, and I'm looking on the cutting room floor for any outtakes, you know.
And what direction did you give to Peter Boyle? Like how he and was Puttin' on the Ritz always the first song choice?
Yes, always. With Irving Berlin, and I said, Peter, sing it from your heart. Sing it like it's a cry of love and freedom and everything you can think of that's good. And he did. Puttin' on the Ritz. I mean, he just, you know.
Here it is from 1974.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mesdames et Messieurs, Damen und Herren, from what was once an inarticulate mass of lifeless tissues, may I now present a cultured, sophisticated man about town. Hit it!
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits? Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes, or cutaway coat, perfect fits. Dressed up like a million-dollar trooper, trying mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper.
Uber, Uber!
Come, let's mix where...
You know, I have to thank you. I have to thank you for that scene. It may be one of my favorite scenes in all of cinema comedy. I'm going to jump to the 2,000-year-old man now. You started this act at parties. You recorded an album. You won a Grammy. You went on from there. I figured before I ask you my questions about the 2,000-year-old man, I'd give a taste. This is from you and Carl on The Andy Williams Show from 1966.
Oh, good. I don't remember that. Let me hear it.
Okay.
Of all the discoveries of all time, what would you consider the greatest? Would you say it was the wheel, the lever, fire?
Fire, fire, far and away, fire. Fire was the hottest thing going. Fire, yeah. You can't beat fire.
Really?
Fire used to warm us and light up our cave so we wouldn't walk into a wall, so we wouldn't marry our brother Bernie.
That's
fire.
Right.
And cooking, oh, fire, you can't beat fire.
When did they first learn to cook with fire?
It was
fire.
An accident. That was an accident. Chicken. Chicken walked into the fire by mistake and over. Burnt up.
Well, pet chicken?
Yes, we did. We didn't use them. We kept them around the cave as pets. We love to hear. We love that.
Oh, they laid
it. So we took it out to give it a funeral, you know, and bury it because it was a pet. And we all went, hey, that smells good. So we ate them up. And since then, we've been eating chickens.
You know, I've heard this story, but I've heard that the animal that wandered into the fire accidentally was a pig.
Not in my cave.
That's Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner in one of their 2,000-year-old man sketches. Do you remember how much of that, if any, was improvised?
Well, actually, when we were on television, we laid out the jokes. We laid out what we would do. When we made our first two albums, I said to Carl, don't tell me anything. Nothing in advance. Just hit me with questions, and when I can't come up with a good answer, cut it. When I come up with a great answer, keep it in. And that's the way we did our first two albums, you know, various characters. And, of course, the 2,000-year-old man emerged as the leading comedy force in the albums.
Carl Reiner is widely and rightly acknowledged as one of the great straight men of all time. And working opposite him must have been a joy. But your friendship with him goes far past the projects you've done together. And now you're getting together almost every night to watch movies and have dinner. It sounds like such a nice thing to do.
Yeah, well, it is. He's my best friend, and, you know, we're like Bialystok and Bloom. We're joined at the hip, and he lost his wife maybe 2 years ago. I lost my wife maybe 10 years ago, so it's actually eight, to be exact. And we miss them, and they loved each other, too, so we can't find any other people that understand our ancient references, you know.
Now, when you guys are watching movies together, just for your own enjoyment, and you're watching comedies, who and what, you know, gets you to laugh the most now?
Oh, well, that's a tough question, because if you say one name, you're going to hurt somebody else's feelings. But, you know,
Exclusionary, what's the last one that you both watched together that made you both laugh? I'm not saying be inclusive, but what's the most recent one?
Well, I think Wreck-It Ralph. We saw the cartoon. We liked it.
Mm-hmm.
With John C. Reilly playing Ralph. I don't know if you know the cartoon.
Yeah, no, I know that.
And we just loved, you know, Penelope, played by Sarah Silverman. She's glorious.
Yes.
And generally, she's one of the few new, you know, there's Amy Schumer has come along, too, who's wonderful. But, I mean, but there are people that come along that are really good and funny, you know, and Sylvan was, we both love her.
I want to play one last clip. This is one that I absolutely adore. It's not a film you directed. It's a remake of To Be or Not to Be, in which you and your wife, Anne Bancroft, play actors in Poland on the eve of World War II.
Oh.
And there's an early scene where you two perform a singing and dancing duet in Polish of Sweet Georgia Brown. To me, it looks like pure joy.
It was pure joy. And Sweet Georgia Brown is one of Anne's favorite songs and one of mine. And, you know, and we'd often sing it together anyway. And because I could do the harmonies and stuff. And when To Be or Not to Be, we said, well, let's do that. But we're in Poland. I suggested we do it in Polish. You know, and just the only English we would do would be Sweet Georgie Brown, you know. And it was, it worked. I mean, I think of all the rehearsals we did and the joy of finally being together, working on a movie together and being there every day. And, you know, so we saw each other for a period of 3 or 4 months, 24 hours a day. And it wasn't bad. It was kind of beautiful.
If you don't mind me asking, this is a personal question, not a cinematic one. Was there a secret to your marriage?
I don't know if there was a secret. I don't know what you would call it. A secret, I think we, from the first minute I saw her, I fell in love, and it lasted until the day she died. That's something. That was the secret. I mean, I just fell in love with her.
Well, that's a pretty good answer. So, thank you. Thank you very much, Mel. Congratulations.
Thank you, David. This has almost been fun.
Mel Brooks speaking to me last May. Coming up, in another of our favorite interviews from 2013, one of the young comics Mel singled out as a current favorite, Amy Schumer. I'm David Biancooley, and this is Fresh Air.